The book of Ruth is the story of a young Moabitess named Ruth who had married into an Israelite family of Elimelech and Naomi, who had themselves migrated out of Israel to the country of Moab. They were residents of Bethlehem in Judah, but because they were in a time of famine, they felt the need to leave their home country and go to the land of Moab. Now, it's during this family's pilgrimage in Moab that Elimelech, the patriarch, died, leaving behind Naomi and two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Now, the boys married themselves some Moabite women. Mahlon married Ruth, and Chilion married a gal named Orpah. And after 10 short years, these two sons of Elimelech and Naomi also passed away, leaving behind now three widows. It was at this point in time that Naomi decided to return to Bethlehem because word had reached here that the famine was over and that God had returned his blessings to the people. And she attempts to release both of her daughter-in-laws back to their people. Orpah returns to her mother's house, but Ruth demonstrates great fidelity to her mother-in-law, Naomi. In fact, this is probably one of the most famous verses from the book of Ruth, what Ruth says to her mother-in-law. In Ruth chapter 1, beginning in verse 16, Ruth says, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may Jehovah do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." And so Ruth travels back with Naomi to Bethlehem. And it's there in Bethlehem that Ruth, through hard, diligent work, attempts to scrape together a meager living for herself and her mother-in-law, Naomi. And providentially, Ruth finds herself gleaning wheat in the field of a certain man named Boaz, who just happened to be a close relative of her deceased father-in-law, Elimelech. And the hard work, integrity, and reputation of Ruth catches the eye of Boaz, who seeks to help her and Naomi in any way that he can. And as was the custom in those days, Boaz redeems the land of Elimelech, his deceased relative, and takes Ruth as his wife to raise up offspring to his fallen brother. Ruth is really a wonderful and heartwarming story. It contains all of the elements of a great novel. There's joy and sadness. There's despair and suspense. There's love and redemption. And there is actually a happily ever after at the end. But have you ever wondered why this short book is included in our scriptures? Why the history of this particular woman is preserved for us today as God's people? Well, you'll notice in Ruth chapter 1 in verse 1, the setting of the book of Ruth, the time period. It says, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land." And so the book of Ruth takes place, this story, this account takes place during the time of the judges. And we think when we look at the book of Judges, that is not a very inspiring book. In fact, I've oftentimes described the book of Judges as the children of Israel's history of circling the toilet bowl of morality being flushed down the drain. And certainly the book of Judges contains and depicts for us the rebellion of Israel. If you go back to Judges chapter 2, notice with me, beginning in verse 11. It says, "Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. And so they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth, and the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies around them so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so that they were severely distressed. And then the rest of that chapter goes on to talk about the fact that when the people would cry out, God would raise up a judge who would deliver them. And yet the people wouldn't learn their lesson. And after a short time of peace, they would again rebel against God. And part of that is because they had failed to do the thing that God had instructed them to do when they went in to take possession of the land, which was utterly destroy the people who inhabited the land. God warned them, if you leave any of them, they will become a thorn in your side, a snare to you. But it's interesting, in Judges chapter 1, beginning in verse 27, we have an account of how each tribe failed to do what God instructed them to do. And so it says in verse 27 of Judges chapter 1, but Manasseh did not take possession of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, nor the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. So the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. And it came about when Israel became strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. And again, Ephraim in verse 29 did not drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer, so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. And in verse 30, Zebulun didn't drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol, so the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. And notice verse 31, Asher, on his part, did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Hoblob or of Achzib or of Helba or of Aphek or of Rehob. So the Asherites, notice this, lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Did you notice that shift there? First, it was that they didn't drive them out, so the Canaanites dwelt among them. But now they're living among the Canaanites. And in verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, and the inhabitants of the land in Beth Shemesh became forced labor for them. But then in verse 34, the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. And yet the Amorites persisted in living in Mount Harris and Ajalon and Shalabim. But when the power of the house of Joseph grew strong, they became forced labor. They failed to do what God said. And indeed, the people of the land became a thorn to them as the Israelites began to become assimilated into the Canaanite peoples. In fact, if you go over to chapter 3, verses 5 through 7. It says, the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters for themselves as wives, and they gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. The Israelites forgot the Lord their God. They forgot that He was their King. He was the one that they should look to for guidance and instruction and direction and protection. And instead they went after these other gods, being seduced by the people of the land. It's interesting to me in Judges chapter 17 and verse 6. And again, it will be repeated as the very last verse in Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. This phrase, this saying, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's a picture of the book of Judges. People rejecting God, people going after other gods, God's people being assimilated into a foreign people and being drawn away from God, failing to recognize God as their king and just doing whatever they wanted to do. Well, perhaps the book of Ruth is given to us to preserve the flip side of that coin. Because if you were to read the book of Judges, you would think there is no hope. Everything is despair. Everything is lost. Everybody's living in rebellion and rejecting God. But probably during the days of Gideon, in Judges chapter 6, we read that the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. And the power of Midian prevailed against Israel because of Midian. The sons of Israel made for themselves the dens which were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. And they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, and they would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Sounds to me like a time of famine in the land when there is no sustenance because the Midianites are coming in and consuming all of it. And so perhaps it was in those days, in Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1 that we're reading, it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, that a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And as we read the story of Ruth, we see this family of Elimelech, that they seem, in contrast to those in the book of Judges who are constantly rebelling against God and forsaking God and doing their own thing, you have this little hamlet in Bethlehem with this family of Elimelech and his relatives, where they seem to be a people who are seeking to serve God and to keep his laws and his commands. They seem to be hardworking and reputable and devout and God-fearing people who are keeping the customs and dwelling in relative peace and prosperity. And it's interesting in the story of Ruth, contrasted with that of Judges, whereas in the book of Judges, it's the people of God who are being assimilated into the nations. In the book of Ruth, you have a foreigner being assimilated into the people of God. And so maybe that's what Ruth is intended to achieve for us, to give us a glimmer of hope, the flip side of the book of Judges. Or perhaps there's more to it than just that. Perhaps the reason why the book of Ruth is preserved for us is so that we have a record of the lineage of King David. Notice how the book of Ruth ends in Ruth chapter 4, beginning in verse 18. It says, "Now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz, by Ruth, was born Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David." But not only does this provide us the link between Judah, which was Perez's father, to King David, it actually provides us the link to the King, Jesus. If you turn over in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, "The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Verse 2, "Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers." And notice verse 3, this is going to start to sound familiar. "Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz," notice this, "by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth," the main character in the book we're looking at today, "and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David, the king. And David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah." And if you continue on down in the genealogy to verse 16, "Jacob ultimately became the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah." It's interesting, in this genealogy of Jesus, there are four women mentioned: Tamar, Ruth, Rahab, and Bathsheba. All of them have interesting stories, but all of them are in the direct lineage of Jesus Christ. Maybe that's why the book of Ruth has been preserved for us, so we understand the background of this famous mother, or great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus of Nazareth. But I would suggest to you that there has to be more that we can learn from this account of Ruth the Moabitess, the great-grandmother of David, the ancestor of Jesus Christ. But in order to learn that lesson, we first need to understand a little bit about who the Moabites were and what was their prior relationship and interaction with the people of God, the Israelites. The Moabites were the descendants of Lot. You remember after Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, Lot fled with his wife and his two daughters. And his wife looked back and became a pillar of salt. And so Lot and his two daughters fled to a cave. And his daughters had assumed that all mankind had been destroyed by the fire and brimstone that came down on Sodom and Gomorrah. And so they concocted a plan to get their dad drunk, to get pregnant by their father, so to preserve mankind. And the Moabites are the result of the union of Lot with his eldest daughter. She bore a son to her father and named him Moab, and he became the father of the Moabites. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 37. And it was because of this relationship that the Moabites bore to the people of Israel. Remember, Lot, the ancestor of the Moabites, was the nephew of Abraham, the ancestor of the Israelites. And so when the Israelites came in to take possession of the land, the Moabites who dwelt on the east side of the Jordan, down towards the southern portion of the Dead Sea, God told the Israelites, you don't harass them. In Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 9, we read, the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. And so the Israelites, after they finished their wilderness wandering, remember they asked to pass through Edom, and the Edomites, who were, by the way, the descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob, would not allow them to pass. And God had previously given them instructions saying, you're not to mess with the descendants of Esau either, because I've given Mount Seir to them. And so they traveled around Edom, and they traveled around Moab, and they came to the plains of Moab. And that's where Og, king of Bashan, tries to come down and fight him, and they take over all of his land, and they take possession of the land on the east side of the Jordan River, but they don't harm the Moabites, or the Ammonites, by the way, because the Ammonites were the sons of Ben-Ammi, who was the son of Lot's youngest daughter through her father. And so they are not allowed to harass them. But interestingly enough, that doesn't prevent the Moabites from functioning as enemies to Israel. You'll remember in Numbers chapter 22 through 24, it was Balak, the king of the Moabites, who commissioned Balaam, the prophet of God, to come and curse the nation of Israel. He was scared to death of them. And you remember Balaam, he talks to his donkey on the trip, and he says, I can only say what God will give me permission to say. And so they go up and they make these sacrifices, and God tells Balaam, you don't get to curse Israel, you're going to bless them instead. And this happens three times. And ultimately, Balaam is unsuccessful in cursing Israel on behalf of Balak, the king of the Moabites, because God prevented him from doing it. In fact, we read in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and in verse 5, nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. Even though Balaam, though, was unsuccessful in getting a curse to be pronounced upon the Israelites by God, he was able to help the Moabites seduce the Israelites into Baal worship and get themselves cursed. We can read in Numbers chapter 25, beginning in verse 1. After the failed attempts of Balaam to curse the Israelites, we read that while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. And they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And we read in Numbers chapter 31 and verse 16 that the subsequent plague that resulted from this idolatry with Baal of Peor was instigated at the advice of Balaam. And so it's interesting, we read in Deuteronomy chapter 23, because of this animosity that the Moabites had towards the Israelites and not accepting them into their land, not allowing them to pass through, not meeting them with bread and water on the way, but instead trying to get them cursed, we read in verse 3 of Deuteronomy chapter 23 that no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Because they did not meet you with food or water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of the Mesopotamia to curse you. So the Moabites don't start out with a great track record against the Israelites. But even later on, God would use the Moabites again to be the oppressors, the punishers of Israel in the time of the judges. In fact, it was Fat King Eglon of the Moabites who came in and suppressed the children of Israel. And it was Ehud, the left-handed judge, who through stealth went in and assassinated King Eglon. I always like that story because it said when he stabbed him, he said that the fat swallowed up the handle of the sword and he left the sword inside of Eglon. And then Ehud leads the Israelites in a war, a small war, against the Moabites, where the Moabites are defeated and repulsed from the land. And Israel enjoys a period of about 80 years of relative peace under the leadership of Ehud. Now, if we're correct in thinking that the events described in the book of Ruth took place during the days of Gideon, then we're nearly a century and a half after the Moabite oppression under King Eglon. So 140 plus years it's been since the Moabites were actively enemies of the Israelites. And so by this time, Moab, being situated east of the Dead Sea, would be a likely place to seek refuge and an attempt to make a life for oneself. And so we shouldn't be surprised to find Elimelech's family choosing to migrate to relatively nearby Moab in this time of conflict and famine when the Midianites are now oppressing the people of Israel. What is surprising to me is that after marrying into the family of Elimelech and being widowed so soon, Ruth chooses to go with Naomi back to Bethlehem. We might be tempted to think that it was just the good nature of Naomi or Elimelech and the righteousness of even Mahlon, Ruth's past husband. Did that so impress Ruth that she was willing to leave her country and her family to be with Naomi and to serve Naomi's God? Well, I would suggest to you that if it was just that Elimelech's family was so righteous and so faithful to God, then both Ruth and Orpah would have followed Naomi. But as we look at the text in Ruth chapter 1, we see that when Naomi begins to set out for home, both of her daughter-in-laws initially follow her. And Naomi tries to persuade them to stay with their families, to go back to their mother's house, and that hoping that God would bless them even though they've lost everything thus far. And it's interesting that Orpah, in verse 14, after lifting up their voices and weeping together, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Orpah goes home to her family, to her mother's house, to serve her people's gods, but Ruth clings to Naomi. And notice Naomi says to her, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But this is where Ruth says, "No, I'm going to go with you. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people will be my people and your God, my God." I would suggest to you that there was something about the nature, the character of Ruth that differentiated her from her sister-in-law. What we know about Ruth is that Ruth was a woman of character. She indeed had a very good reputation. Ruth chapter 2, verse 5, we read, "Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' Looking at Ruth. And the servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after your reapers among the sheaves.' And thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She is sitting in the house for a little while." In verse 10, "Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner?'" And notice what Boaz says. He says, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." And later on in chapter 3 and verse 11, Boaz, again speaking to her, makes this observation. He says, "Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." She obviously had a great reputation among the people in Bethlehem. And I think that's partly because she was clearly a selfless person. In verse 10, when she has approached Boaz and asked him to marry her, he says to her, May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first being a reference to her leaving her family and her country and coming to take care of her mother-in-law, Naomi. Because he says, you didn't go after a young man, whether poor or rich. She wasn't looking out for herself when she was seeking a new husband. She was looking out for her family. And she was unafraid of hard work. We read there already in chapter 2 when she's gleaning in the field that she's going to gather up. And gleaning is where they would harvest the wheat, and whatever kind of fell behind, people were allowed to come in and pick that and gather that up. It was labor-intensive work. It was hard work. And yet she's going to go out to do this to provide for herself and for her mother-in-law. And it's interesting, in verse 7, we read this already, she had come to the field of Boaz and said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from morning until now, apparently midday. But if you jump down in the text, you realize that she stays not just till midday, but until evening, verse 17. And then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And this she does until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, verse 23. And so she's a woman who is not afraid of working hard to provide for herself and for her loved ones. And that's because she genuinely cared for and loved her family. In fact, it's interesting the compliment that's paid to her in chapter 4 and verse 15. The friends of Naomi are saying to her, "May he," that is this son who's been born to Ruth and Boaz, "may he be a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, and your daughter-in-law, Ruth, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." So you see this woman of great character. But I would suggest to you it was not any of these things that prompted Ruth to come with Naomi. Rather, I think the key is in the fact that she sought after the God of Israel, the Lord. It's interesting there. This is Boaz speaking in chapter 2 and verse 12, but I think he's spot on in his observation. He said, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Ruth, like other women before her, for example, Rahab, the mother of Boaz, recognize something about the God of Israel. Because she saw that he was different than the gods of the land, she sought to seek after him, to be in a relationship with him. And indeed, the Lord saw this and looked favorably upon her. It was the Lord who providentially looked out for her and guided her to the field of Boaz, the close relative of Elimelech, her father-in-law. And it was God who blessed her to conceive and bear a child, Obed, who would become the grandfather of a king, David, and ultimately the king, Jesus. But here we have a paradox. That is something that seems to be a contradiction, if not near impossible. Because you remember what God declared back in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 3? That no Ammonite or Moabite would enter into the assembly of God. not even to the 10th generation, they would be excluded. And yet here we have Ruth, a Moabite woman, who is assimilated into the family of Elimelech. Not only does she become a part of the people of God, but within four generations, her descendant David becomes arguably the greatest king over the assembly of the Lord. How could that be? Well, again, I think it's because of Ruth's heart. Ruth was the type of woman who sought after the true God. And I think the point of the book of Ruth is the same point, the lesson that's being taught is the same lesson that Peter learned when he went and preached to the household of Cornelius. In Acts chapter 10, verse 34, opening his mouth, Peter said, "I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him." And maybe we add the man or woman who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. You see, it doesn't matter who your parents are. It doesn't matter where you were born. It doesn't matter your nationality or the color of your skin or your heritage. It doesn't matter where you've been or what you've done or perhaps what you failed to do in the past. If you have a heart that is truly set on seeking and serving and submitting yourself to God, God will welcome you into his family. It is so true what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7. Verses 7 and 8, "Ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be open." So not only will God accept you into his people, into his family, into his household, if you truly ask and seek and knock after him, but then just like Ruth, he will use you to accomplish his plan and bring about his purposes in your life. Let's be like Ruth and have a heart that is set on seeking the one true God.